Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and I swear, this is my favorite podcast to date. Adrian Wojnarowski from The Vertical joins me with all you need to know about free agency that opens on Thursday night. Plus, Orlando Magic head coach Frank Vogel takes us inside his end in Indiana and why Orlando was the right fit. That's next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome back. Another episode of The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We'll check in with Frank Vogel, the new head coach of the Orlando Magic. He's going to join us a little bit later on. But first, free agency. Just a couple of days away. Over at The Vertical, we'll be doing a live broadcast on Thursday night, late night broadcast with all the latest information on free agency. You can check that out at thevertical.com. We'll be tweeting about it all week long. It'll be out there. We had a terrific time doing the draft show, a lot of success with that, and we're going to take it to the next level, doing it on the eve of free agency. To talk more about that, nobody better than my colleague, Adrian Wojnarowski over at The Vertical. And a lot to get to, Woj, with specifics, but I want to start with how crazy the first week of July is going to be. We've been kind of preparing for what the enhanced cap is going to look like, the potential free-for-all money-wise is going to look like. What kind of sticker shock can we expect in this first few days?
Chris, yeah, it's, first of all, good to be here with you. It will be massive. I think, you know, people expect to see the big numbers on the max contracts. People are accustomed to that. What the teams are preparing for, what the agents are preparing for, are that mid-level player, in some cases guys who aren't even starters where they are, getting $11, $12, $13 million a year offers. The cap jumps to approximately $94 million. There is so much money to spend, so many teams with a lot of space, and they've got to build rosters. They've got to meet the cap floor, and you're going to see players like Jeremy Lin and Bismack Biyombo and Tyler Johnson, who's a restricted free agent, Alan Crabb, not all starters, several of which have come off the bench this year, looking at either offer sheets or straight free agent deals in the $12, $13, $14, $15 million a year range.
When I talk to GMs about this summer, it's, you know, we've been preparing for this, we've been doing all that we can, but there's always this bit of skepticism, bit of doubt from general managers who can't really fully wrap their head around what this is going to look like in the coming weeks.
The conversations that I've been having with guys, it's like, you keep saying, like, the conversation isn't, well, what do you think he deserves? It's, what is he going to get? Because those are two different things. And I think people are starting to get, what'll be interesting, and Daryl Morey said this on my podcast with him a couple of weeks ago, is after the max guys go early, that there may be a little bit of a hesitation period there where no GM wants to be the first guy in at a really high number that's too much, that's going to, when he hasn't seen what other comparable players are getting, and no agent wants to feel like he's going in too low, and then all of a sudden some other guys usurp his deal, that there may be a feeling out period where everyone's trying to figure out what is he worth. And it just takes one team. Jeremy Lin is out there. His market right now is 12, 13, 13 million plus a year. He's a backup point guard. He was a backup in Charlotte. Now, there are teams where they project him potentially as a starting player, but they're not elite teams. They're maybe not even good teams, but there's 30 teams and everybody, it's not a great point guard group. And he brings some other qualities, some marketing, some things that, you know, other players don't have that come with Jeremy Lin with his popularity. And he's a guy who's going to capitalize on this market. Charlotte's an interesting team with the money they're going to have to outlay, Chris. Steve Clifford's done such a great job of maximizing the value of the players who went in there. Nick Batum is looking at a $20 million plus. Marvin Williams' market, I'm told, is in the $14, $15 million a year. Now, that can change, but I know that's what Charlotte's sort of budgeting for. Courtney Lee's a player they would love to keep. He's going to be over $10 million on the market. They may not be able to pay him. And Jeremy Lin, I think it's going to be really hard for them to keep him. And Al Jefferson in the middle. So I think the priorities in Charlotte, for example, are Batum and Marvin Williams, and then everyone will fall in line after those two.
You wrote a piece early in the season about Steph Curry and how he handled being the fifth highest paid Warrior on that team. And Steph was magnanimous about it, said, you know, it is what it is. I don't let it bother me. But I'm curious, do you hear anything about possible fears of, you know, seeing a team next year where your star player is making $15 million and a Kent Bazemore or a Jeremy Lin or a Marvin Williams is making more than him?
There's no question. I think it's going to be twofold. It's going to be the guys who walk into teams at really high numbers this year and how that impacts the players around them. Because even with the money being, it's like a fun house. It's like you're walking into like the fun house and the mirror, everything's exaggerated. And not only the established players of that team looking at it, but where teams talk about the impact coming and agents feel like they're going to feel it is, the cap going up this year artificially just allows a certain group of players to benefit. What the league wanted to do was that smoothing plan, which was they would gradually increase the cap over the next 3 or 4 years and allow players over the next few years to all share in this money. The union said, no, those guys will benefit because the salaries will go up this year, and then those guys will benefit, the marketplace will be set, and they're going to get paid too. Now, that may or may not work that way, but how's it going to impact a locker room when, let's use Jeremy Lin or Kent Bazemore as an example, if Kent stays in Atlanta or goes somewhere else, another player next year who says, hey, I'm as good as Kent Bazemore, I'm as good as Jeremy Lin, or the following year, well, he may not get paid like him. And that can create strife in locker rooms. You may see like a crop of agents get fired by their clients over the next couple of years because they couldn't deliver. You know, players in the next 2 or 3 years will see deals done this year that they think, hey, I'm better than that guy, I've been more productive. Well, once the cap sort of levels off, the money won't be there for those guys. And how does that impact locker rooms and teams and organizations? It's going to be, we've never seen anything like this.
I know you're going to be doing something separate on Kevin Durant and all the layers of his free agency in your own podcast later on this week. But the lay of the land right now, do you look at it as a Durant is entering free agency and it is anyone can grab Kevin Durant, that it's a wide open sort of race? Or do you think that he is strongly leaning at this point one way or the other?
I think, Chris, Oklahoma City is a strong front runner, but we know in these things, it can change. You get into meetings and July 1 comes, and if Kevin goes through with the meetings, listen, there's nothing stopping him still from the day before on June 30th to say, send a tweet out and say, hey, I'm staying. Like, I don't think that's what he's going to do, but his plan is to go through with the meetings right now. And I reported the other day on The Vertical, besides Oklahoma, Golden State, San Antonio, the Celtics, the Miami Heat, and the Los Angeles Clippers. Now, there could be some additions to that. There could be some other people, other teams who get an audience. But right now, that appears to be the group. And those are the teams that I know are planning to come in on the first day and possibly second day. I don't think they'll all be in one day. But your head can always get turned when you get in the room. And whether it's the Golden State contingent, you know, Draymond Green and Steph Curry come in, the Spurs, you know, this. I wrote a long piece after free agency last year about LaMarcus Aldridge's process and how he went into it thinking one thing and then his head started to turn. Now, LaMarcus, his mind was much more on leaving than Kevin's is. But right now, there are a lot of teams coming in who really, on Truth Serum, will tell you, we really feel like we are laying the groundwork for the 2017 free agency when we know he may really be on the market. That there's still an expectation he'll go back to Oklahoma, but I don't think Sam Presti's sleeping great right now. He knows that you lose control as an organization. You lose, you know, all of a sudden something resonates with him, and then maybe he decides, you know what, maybe I want to get on a plane and go see them or go to that city. That isn't the plan now. I'm told there could be a decision. He's not looking to have a drawn-out process, but free agent processes are always a roller coaster. And to sit here and say, well, he's definitely going back to Oklahoma, I'm not going to report that or say that because things change.
Did Oklahoma City help itself with that Serge Ibaka trade? Because You would imagine one way or the other, they were keenly aware of Durant's thoughts on the Ibaka trade. Getting Oladipo back, Sabonis, you know, layering a little more depth onto that team. Do you think that they helped their chances, or was it not relevant in the Durant
discussion? Well, you wrote a great piece on it, Chris, on the Vertical about, you know, the reasons Oklahoma City did it and what led to it. There's no question there's been some friction, and it really started to manifest itself more this year, this past season in Oklahoma with their big three. And I think for Serge Ibaka, he's always been a distant third. Anybody who plays with Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant, you're going to have a distant secondary role offensively. They've wanted Serge to really be locked in defensively, you know, that he should be the best defensive player in the league. He's a great shot blocker and defender and, you know, and an opportunistic offensive player who, you know, could step out and hit a three. But the ball didn't go to him as much as, and Andy Miller, his agent, said it to you on the record, that Billy Donovan had made a case to him that he'd be more involved offensively going into the year, and it didn't happen. That there was some tension and friction in that group. There are on almost every team with any three together is always hard. Two can work, like, but three together, even when, like, you're a kid, like, there was always some weird dynamic when you had brought a third kid into it. And there's some truth to that here, but Sam Presti made this deal knowing how Kevin Durant felt about it. Of course he did. And I do know that for Kevin Durant, getting back Victor Oladipo, who he has some ties back in the Washington, D.C. area. They got some Victor's younger, but he's a player that Durant's very fond of. Had that great 40-plus game, that overtime game against the Thunder down in Orlando, played well against them. I think from a basketball standpoint, I don't know that that deal makes the Thunder better. Now, if you want to say from a chemistry standpoint that those guys couldn't coexist anymore and that was the best deal they could get, I'll buy that. But if you say to me that, hey, I think Victor, and I like Victor a lot, and I think coming in with a veteran team and this group, I think his game will become more efficient. Sabonis is going to be a good player, but he's not going to step in and help you in the playoffs. No rookie is coming in and doing that. But I do think the case can be made that they needed to make the deal. And, of course, Serge is going to be a free agent next year. At the end of next season, they knew they were going to lose him for nothing. And so, like the Harden situation, they got out ahead of it.
Yeah, this is what Oklahoma City does and has done with situations like this. Harden, Reggie Jackson, you know, they don't wait for things to continue to devolve or for the possibility of losing a guy that they know does not want to be there. But I agree with you on the trade. I don't think they have an answer for who is going to be their power forward and how they're going to play in that front court. I mean, you hear, well, we play Enes Kanter more. He showed last year in the playoffs that he could play alongside Steven Adams. Steven Adams showed last year in the playoffs, I hear from them, that he can defend power forwards. Kevin Durant can play power forward next year if he comes back. I think that's a bigger problem than they are at least letting on at the moment. I like Oladipo, too. I think he's going to help them defensively going after Klay Thompson and Steph Curry and, you know, the collection of guards, but I think that front court, Sabonis, if they're expecting Sabonis to play, it'd be surprising anyway if he can play real minutes in a postseason game.
Yeah, this was a significant decision for Oklahoma City on the eve of Durant's free agency, but again, it gets back to the fact that as an organization, you're deciding not just what makes us better, but what do we think Kevin and Russell Westbrook, his free agency is coming up too. It's a twofold decision, where they're already thinking about what are the right players to play around them. Sam Presti said something interesting to me on the podcast I did with him a couple of weeks ago. He said that it's been a challenge for him, and he's like a good challenge, that as Westbrook and Durant's games have evolved, as they've grown as players and added more dimensions, the players who fit around them have to change and complement them, and that it's sort of been a challenge for his front office and coaching staff to always be really studying that and seeing maybe what fit 2 years ago or a year ago, maybe it doesn't fit as much right now, and that's been an interesting challenge for him and putting the pieces together around him.
All right, talk to me about the free agents who are not free agents at this point, basically. The guys that you think are focused more on re-signing with their own teams. There are some names out there that seem like they're on that track. I mean, DeMar DeRozan with Toronto has been very vocal for months, even when he came on my podcast months ago, that he wanted to come back. to Toronto, Al Horford in Atlanta, Nick Batum in Charlotte. Those players, they seem like they're at least, you know, from the outside, yeah. looks like they're focused on being back with their old teams.
And they all are. And even on the inside, they all are. You know, what you're seeing right now is the posturing going on between the players and the agents and the teams where, listen, some of these guys may take a little bit less than the max in the end, but they're going to push and push and threaten to leave unless they get the full max. Like, if I don't get the full max, I'm going to go out on the market. You're going to hear a lot of that in the next few days, whether it's Connolly, Al Horford, Nick Batum, DeMar DeRozan. Now, I'm not sure any of those guys are going to get the full five-year max. They may get something south of it and say, okay, like, the teams are going to sell them on, come on, we want to continue to put good players around you. Allow us to keep building a team, but you got your fifth year and you're getting, you know, close to that max number. And then it's kind of a dance between the team and, you know, all these teams want to keep those players from going to take meetings. Batum in Charlotte, I think he really liked playing there. I'm told he really enjoyed playing for Steve Clifford, playing with that group. And does a player like Nick Batum really want the pressure of taking a max deal somewhere else and all of a sudden trying to be something he really isn't, which is the guy? Batum's not the guy, but economics are going to dictate he's going to get a max deal. You know, these are all, you look at this group, all pretty mature, level-headed guys that like where they are, have all had pretty good success where they are. Batum's shorter term, but DeRozan, Eastern Conference Finals, and all's become, he's become a perennial all-star there. Al Horford in Atlanta, they've had really good success. Mike Connolly, great success in Memphis. These are guys who have good relationships with their teammates, with the organization in general. And, you know, they are the ones who, the system was designed by the league to make it hard for guys like this to leave. If I'm Mike Connolly and I can have, what, $35 million, whatever that number is going to be in his fifth year, if he does a four-year deal somewhere else at a lower number, when he's 33 or 34 years old, he's not getting a new deal that starts in the 30s. He's had injuries. He'll wear down. He knows that economically this is his best deal. And they all these players know this too. If it doesn't work out in like whichever player it is, let's take the money now, take the guaranteed years. If I need to force a trade later, or if I need to push to get out, I can always do that. Carmelo Anthony was a good example of that. He was intrigued by Chicago, but in the end, he took the full five-year max, or a little less than that full five-year max. And I remember a line somebody around Melo said to me then. It was, you know, take the money now, fix the destination later if you need to. And I think guys know that can be done.
The Horford is interesting to me just because on draft night on the show, we talked a lot about what's the direction of Atlanta right now. They trade away Jeff Teague. They're handing the team basically over from a point guard perspective to Dennis Schroeder. They draft two wing players in the first round, which suggests perhaps they're not going to break the bank to keep Kent Bazemore. Do any of these, is your understanding that any of these deals, do they have any impact on how Atlanta's looking at Al Horford, if there's a limit to what they're going to spend on Al Horford?
I think Atlanta is committed to trying to keep Al Horford. Now, again, it's a dance. It's a negotiation. You never know how far a team's going to go until they're pressed. I would think Atlanta would like to try to have something in place here before midnight on Thursday and to keep, you know, do they want Al to go get romance by the Celtics or the Blazers or some other very good teams where if you plugged Al in, they'd be even better in basketball-crazed NBA markets? Atlanta, they've done a great job in Atlanta, but Al could get seduced by another place where maybe there's more, I'm going to say more history. Atlanta's got great history, but it's a risk. And so, but they're going to try to get him for as little as possible and allow them to keep putting pieces around. But Atlanta's committed. They want to keep him. I think they've been fairly aggressive in sort of the initial talks there, I'm told. So I think it's similar like DeRozan. It's a dance between the agent, the player, and the team to try to see how close to the max they can get. Or maybe a couple of these guys are going to say, I want the full max. I'm not giving you a cent less. But given that group of players we've been talking about, they're so invested in those places and they want to win, they may give a little bit because they're still going to get more than, even less than the max is more than anybody else can offer them.
Where's Boston's best chance of success on July 1st? Because they, you know, they're not shy about telling everyone they intend to be aggressive on the trade market. on the free agent market. When you look at the landscape, where is their best chance of finding a difference maker?
Well, I mean, they've been aggressive, and they have nothing to show for it. It's been 2 years of, you know, you look back when they put their championship team together, and they had assets. Probably, if you look back, probably less than they do now in terms of picks. I mean, how fortunate they were to get the Ray Allen deal done with Seattle at the time and get the Kevin Garnett deal done with Minnesota. And with the cap going up, the one thing you don't see as much right now that would be opportunistic for Boston is when the cap was lower and teams were like, hey, I can't pay everybody here. We can't pay our second guy. We can't pay this third guy. We have to move him. We're not going to pay all. Well, now teams are – the cap's gone up. Teams are able to project their payroll over the next couple of years that you don't see teams handcuffed right now saying, I can't pay this guy. We got to trade him. So Boston hasn't benefited from that. Now, that was – Ray Allen and KG weren't that. KG wanted out, and at the time, Seattle, Sam Presti were just rebuilding. Boston hasn't – two things they haven't done here. They haven't been able to turn those assets into a really good veteran star. And they have not capitalized on their draft picks. We'll see how Jaylen Brown works out. We'll see how this draft works out. You never know. But last year's draft, Rozier and Hunter, you know, it's one thing to have all these picks. It's another thing to make the right pick. So Boston's still got a lot of work to do, or they're going to get stuck in this place they are now, which is maybe a, you know, maybe a first round, you know, at best a second round conference semi-loser. Like, they can't get over this hump until they make another impactful move. The team they have, they continues to be a playoff team, but, you know, their aspirations are obviously bigger than that.
One question I wanted to ask you, and this sort of connects to the Kevin Durant pursuit because this player, this team is involved. Harrison Barnes, you know, expectations are he's going to get a really, really big contract, and he should in this market. But is it possible that we'll see a team try to sign Harrison Barnes or offer Harrison Barnes some kind of max-level deal at 12:01, if for no other reason than to put pressure on Golden State to make a decision while they wait for Kevin Durant to make his?
Well, the one thing, it is possible someone does that, Chris. The moratorium ends on July 6th, so they'll know by July 6th whether they have to match that. He can't sign that sheet. The clock doesn't start on that sheet until he can sign it. So Golden State would know whether they were going to get Kevin Durant or not. So they don't have to make a decision right away. With the restricted free agents, there's not a super advantage to doing it on day one because then you're giving the other team several days to map out its strategy and how to match it, move some other salaries around. But I do think Harrison Barnes, there's going to be a big deal out there for him, whether it's a Boston, a Memphis. You know, there's lots of teams who need wings. And I want to bring up one other thing on Harrison Barnes. And when I reported the other day that he had made the Olympic team, you know, the reaction of people was, geez, we're going to lose. How can you put – I would just say this. Like, enough guys have turned it down that it's going to get the guys like Harrison Barnes. But I think people have to understand Harrison Barnes isn't going to play on that team. If you can't win a gold medal at forward with Kevin Durant, Paul George, Carmelo Anthony, like starting with those three – like, I don't care if you and I are like at playing at 11 and 12 sitting there on the bench, like, you're going to win the gold medal. What was interesting with Barnes is, and a lot of credit to his former agent, Jeff Wexler, who told him to go to those USA Select things and say, you never know, like, you're sort of like a tackling dummy at some of those things. And he was like, hey, what I was told was, he was like, hey, I'm probably not going to ever make the team. And he said, no, go, because there's general managers there watching you. There's, you know, other teams are watching you for free agency. It's a good experience to play in there. And so Harrison Barnes went through their program for a couple of years, never imagined he would be on this team. And then guys start dropping out. And regardless of the poor finals he had and, you know, so-so postseason, he gets to be an Olympian. And it just showed, like, you know, Chris, like, half a life is showing up. And he showed up at those trials, and he was a guy who had invested in their program. And so when they had to choose between him and some other guys, they're like, hey, Harrison Barnes has been here. He's come to our Vegas things, and Gordon Hayward turns it down, and Harrison Barnes gets the next thing. But I remember this from a couple past Olympics. The Olympic guys on the Olympic staff will always say to you, you got to have a couple guys who will sit well. The idea of bringing 12 stars doesn't work because they're not going to play 12 guys. And so I remember when Carlos Boozer was on an Olympic team, they always said Boozer was a great guy for that team, because he was fine with sitting. He was fine being a cheerleader. And you need to have a guy like Harrison Barnes who just says, hey, like, I know I'm fortunate to be here, and he's not going to complain or mope. I think that there is some value in he's still better than any other three-man anybody. You know, I guess we could think of a couple here, but they'll be fine with him, mm-hmm. I guess is my point.
All right, hang tight for a second, Woj. I got to tell our listeners about your favorite product. I know because I listen to you say it with gusto on your podcast, Jack Irwin Shoes. And who doesn't take pride in finding a good pair of shoes? I got my Jack Irwin Shoes, and let me tell you, I wear them around all the time. Every suit that I put on, I make sure I wear my Jack Irwin Shoes with them. Jack Irwin was founded by two guys who couldn't find a great pair of clean, well-made dress shoes at a reasonable price, so they set out to create shoes for every man's wardrobe at prices they can afford. Their direct-to-consumer business model allows Jack Irwin to sidestep traditional retail markups and offer high-quality shoes at an accessible price. The average price is $195, whereas other shows of the same quality cost 2 to 3 times more. These are simply designed, well-made, and well-priced men's shoes. Styles range from lace-ups and boots to loafers, casual to dress. Go to www.jackirwin.com right now to receive free overnight shipping on your purchase by using my code Chris. That's www.jackirwin.com. Select the overnight shipping option on the site and enter the code Chris to receive the offer. That's jackirwin.com, J-A-C-K-E-R-W-I-N. Enter code Chris at checkout to get free overnight shipping on your order.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
One of the bigger names out there, and maybe not the best name out there, Dwight Howard. Oh,
I can't wait for the Dwight free agent. I can't. The market's going to be fascinating.
It is going to be fascinating, well, because I can't read it yet. I can't see where he fits in at the moment financially. I can see where he fits in from Dwight Howard, the player, works here. I can't see where he fits in money-wise.
Listen, it only takes one. He's going to want security. I've had a few teams say to me, we would look at him maybe on a one-year deal at a big number, but I really think it's going to be hard. I'm not saying impossible, and he probably will find one, but I think it will be hard to find teams who want to give him 3 years. I don't think he'll get four at a big number for a lot of reasons. Health, how he's going to fit into certain teams, but you know, he opted out of that deal, and usually when you opt out of a deal like that, you know you have something else there, out there. And he may know he has something. I don't know where it is. And he'll meet with teams, and I know there's a market, but the idea of him getting a 3-year max or 4-year max, that would shock me. I think you could get 1 year at a big number somewhere, but the rest of Dwight's career might be piecing together 1 year here, 1 year here, unless he goes somewhere and really solidifies himself. But it will be really interesting to see how it plays out for Dwight, because I do think if you're willing to pay him, I think like he was pretty choosy with Houston. With Houston, he could pick where he wanted to go. And hey, the Warriors were in there recruiting Dwight Howard at that time in Dallas. And of course, the Lakers wanted to keep him. He's not going to have those options this time. And it's going to be, it may not be a place you love. It may not be a team that's any good. It may not be a place warm, but if they're going to pay Dwight, I think that's probably where he's going to be headed.
Yeah, I think when he opted out, my initial thought was because the cap floor is going to be what it is, he'll be able to get, if he wanted a 1-year deal at 20-something, he'd be able to get that. Just yes. Because you have to reach that floor. And the floor, I think, was higher than the actual cap was this past season, or is going to be higher than what the cap was this past season. But the perception of Dwight that's out there, is it one where they look at him as potentially a negative influence in the locker room, or is it one where they say, you know, he's not the old Dwight Howard, he doesn't fit in what we're trying to do, big centers are kind of going away? Is it a mix of both? I mean, what do you see it as?
I think it's a mix of both. I think that, listen, it didn't work well with his teammates in LA, and then in Houston, it wasn't great. Now, those were strong personalities, Kobe and James Harden, but at some point, Dwight's got to be responsible, too, for how he's viewed. And it's not just players at times. It's coaches and front office. And you know, we've been through this a lot with Dwight. I like Dwight. I think he tries to do the right thing. And I think sometimes, you know, either he's impulsive with what he says or does, or doesn't think out the impact a certain thing is going to have on his teammates or the group. But listen, the guy was a great player and worked really hard on his game. He was a dominant player in the league. He's not that guy anymore, but he's still better than a lot. And the other point you made, too, is the league has changed and how teams are playing has changed. And, I mean, it was funny when Mike D'Antoni took over and He said, oh, I want Dwight to opt in for a year. He fits into what we're doing. No, he doesn't. He doesn't. Mike, he didn't fit into it in L.A., and he doesn't fit here. But they wanted to keep him. He was an asset. I get it. But it's just the league has changed around him. And, you know, Dwight's body has changed, you know, his health. But
don't you think if Dwight would, you know, in a perfect world, Dwight
if he would embrace a role.
Yes. Be comfortable being second or third wheel on a successful team, because I don't think his game hurts him that much. If you're, you know, if you're willing to take a what would still be a pretty fat contract, except being a defender, a post player, but guy getting 12 shots per game, average. And this kind of like reminds me of like the Serge Ibaka situation. Like Serge, if he would just be a defender and a low rim runner type of scorer,
they would have never traded him.
Never in a million years. No. Dwight kind of is the same type of guy.
Right. If he would Dwight accept still this, wants that offense to go through him, and it's not. He's not an efficient offensive player. He never has. You still can't throw the ball to him late in the games because he still can't shoot free throws. You know, he's a high turnover player. He's a low efficiency offensive player. And Stan Van Gundy always found that balance with him in Orlando. He was a more explosive player than he would rim run and throw lobs to him. And listen, he played very well for Houston in the playoffs against Portland 2 years ago. And then last year, you know, he's had some really good series for them in the postseason. But he wants to still be that offensive, I want to say centerpiece, but he wants a bigger role on offense than anybody wants to give him. And I do think if he embraced being a defender, you know, that physical presence on the defensive board, shot blocker, then he would have great value than people. But if they know that he's going to complain about touches, if he's going to mope, if the body language isn't going to be there, if he's going to start chirping about it in the media or in the locker room, they don't want to deal with it.
Another risky big man that's on the market is down in Miami, Hassan Whiteside. And, you know, two consecutive really good years for Hassan Whiteside. Maybe great in terms of the center position years for Hassan Whiteside. He hits free agency this summer. The Heat, they say they want to bring him back. He said some really interesting things about
I'm a businessman who happens to play basketball.
Yeah, and then he's at a press conference and he's saying, you know, we'll see what happens in Miami. It just doesn't sound like he's eager to go back there. Now, maybe it's just posturing on his part. Who knows? But, you know, I don't know if he's, you know, mature enough to have that perspective. But what do you see the market for him? We've talked to the market about a lot of guys.
I think there's max offers out there for
him.
Wow. I do.
And, even giving the off-the-court stuff. And,
you know, and Miami is going to probably have to be, you know, I think in a perfect world, Miami would do a deal where they would, where he would feel some loyalty to them. You know, you resurrected my career. He had been bounced out of the league. He had been overseas in the D League and, you know, brought Adam Simon, one of the great, you know, assistant GM in Miami, mm-hmm. and Eric Spoelstra and Pat Riley, you know, felt like here was a guy we could bring in and he could be impactful and or may have an opportunity. And they built his career back and gave him an NBA career. Now, that doesn't mean he owes them everything, but I think in a perfect world, they hope that that would mean something. I think in a perfect world, Miami could have some protections in a contract that if he goes off the rails again on them, that they're not liable for all that money guaranteed. But that's not the real world, and he's going to have suitors out there,
teams out there who are willing to
go full max. And so Miami's got an interesting situation there in terms of sort of the allocation of like their money. You have Whiteside, you have Tyler Johnson as a restricted free agent who I really think teams are targeting because they know more than, listen, Portland with Allen Crabbe, they're going to match that. You know, some of the other restricted free agents who you feel like their teams are going to match, Harrison Barnes is going to get matched if they're not getting Durant. But Miami with Dwayne Wade's, they're going to have to do a new deal for Wade. They got to figure out Whiteside. And then Chris Bosh, who there's just no answer right now to whether he's going to play for them again and whether that money is going to continue to, it may just have to continue on the cap until next February when he's out a full year and insurance could take part. But right now, listen, hopefully something comes and there's a solution medically that allows him to play, but there isn't one right now. And what is his future there? So is Whiteside willing to concede? And then if you're Dwayne Wade, he has sacrificed financially in several scenarios there. He brought in, Dwayne Wade built this whole thing, and he brought in LeBron James and Chris Bosh and gave up money to allow them to do other things. Now, like if you're Dwayne Wade and Pat Riley comes to you next week and says, we can get Kevin Durant, will you take less? Of course he's going to. But what if Pat Riley comes to him and says, we really want you to still take a lot less for that next level down player or two levels down player? Then it'll be interesting to see where Dwayne's head is, say like, do I have to sacrifice money again? I've given back a lot over time, and you know, maybe you're talking to me about a player who really isn't going to impact winning in a big way here. He's just the best that we can get right now. That will be interesting in the process. So Miami's got a lot of their next week in 10 days is going to be really interesting.
San Antonio was the team that made the biggest splash last year in free agency, landing LaMarcus Aldridge. And even though they got beat in the second round, that was still a terrific year for the Spurs, 67 wins. I still maintain, which I think that might have been the best Spurs team the last 20 years, despite the fact they lost. That just shows how great the Western Conference is and how great a team Oklahoma City was. But what do? Every year they try to supplement the roster a little bit. They try to get some veteran, some piece that can add to their group. What do they look at besides, you know, obviously making the run at a guy like Durant?
Yeah, I'm told that Pau Gasol is a real priority for them. They tried to get him before he signed with Chicago. The Bulls were able to offer him a little bit more than the mid-level that year. I think the Spurs had a mid-level for him. They can maneuver in San Antonio and probably be able to offer him a market value. We'll see what that's going to be. You know, Tim Duncan's future is still uncertain. You know, it's Tim Duncan's date is coming up here soon where he's got to either opt into his deal or into the final year. Now, he can opt into the deal, get his money, and still decide to retire, and then the Spurs could pay him almost as a going away. But I don't know that you're going to have a answer on Tim Duncan's future before the start of free agency. But listen, he's as liable to walk into Pop's office any day and say, hey, I'm playing or I'm not playing. They'll call R.C. Buford in. Hey, okay. Let's call his agent, Tim Tanner, and that's it. Or this may linger. I think there's some different scenarios in play for Tim about, well, maybe you could play a certain amount of games. And I think there's a strong belief that Manu Ginobili is probably going to play another year. I think he's not tying himself to Tim on what Tim does. It's not like, hey, we're going to go out together. I think Manu feels, if he feels like he has more in him, he's going to play. And then David West, who going into this year, people around David West said this was going to be his last year. And I remember talking to him in the preseason about that and going down to San Antonio. And he thought, like, could be. And I think now he enjoyed that year so much in San Antonio. He's a free agent, so they can look to – and they, of course they'd want to keep him. I'll say this about David West. Whenever he decides to retire, he will be the most sought-after front office executive in the league. Everybody in the league wants to get David West in their front office. He's going to be a GM someday if that's what he wants to do. But boy, I know like it will be hard to pluck him out of – like once he's gotten into San Antonio, I would be shocked if he doesn't end up – have the opportunity to get in their front office. But I know other organizations would love to get him, the league office, I'm sure. Like David West, you know, he's just everything you want in a player, a leader, a great thinker, a high-character guy, just – and the Spurs loved having him, and they really want him to – they really hope he plays another year.
That's interesting because, you know, West – articulate guy. You can clearly tell he's a bright guy. That's interesting that he's looked at as the next big star in the player turned executive ranks. I want to ask you about Sacramento and keeping with kind of the big man theme that's out there right now. The Kings had an interesting draft. They draft Papianis high, and DeMarcus Cousins had that tweet. He later said he wasn't talking about it. I was told he absolutely was talking about that pick and that he doesn't like the draft the Kings had all that well. I mean, 2 years left in his contract. The contract to me is probably the most appealing part of DeMarcus right now. I mean, yeah, he's a talented guy and can be an impact player, but it feels like every, you know, sort of six-month block that passes, he's going to fetch less and less in a trade if they ultimately deal him. What do you think the mindset?
I think teams are clawing to get at him. I do. Yeah. I think teams, the minute Sacramento says he's available, I think they're going to get really good bids for him. I think the talent will blind people. Teams are going to say, it'll be different with us. We'll give him a better organization, a better atmosphere. We'll surround him with A, B, and C. Like, that talent is so hard to get at. Like, how else do you get a player of that ability on your roster? And I think that the market will be strong for him. I do. Despite all the reasons it should, maybe it shouldn't be, I think teams will sort of slough it off on saying, well, it's just – it's a dysfunctional environment there, and you know DeMarcus has his issues, and we know we've got to deal with him, but the talent is just undeniable. Now, I think teams have been trying to feel Sack out a little bit about whether he could be available. I think a year ago, they talked to the Lakers for a short time and then pulled him back off. Sacramento did. I think there's a sense teams are wondering that they might be willing to have conversations about him, that they've softened a little bit. That now, that's a big difference from shopping somebody, but I think there's a feeling here as we get toward free agency that there could be conversations, that you can have a conversation with the Kings about Cousins. And then we'll see if that door opens up. The Papianis pick at 13, you say, geez, they took a center. You know, after trading Marquise, the rights to Marquise Chris, they have a lot of young bigs there. Willie Cauley-Stein, you know, Papianis comes over. I mean, he's not ready to be a starter in the league. But, you know, what could they get for him? So they're not there yet. Teams, I've asked teams about it in the last few days. Nobody's really had dialogue with them, but they do feel like it's not as stern of a no as it was before. So we'll see how that plays out.
You know what you're not going to hear from DeMarcus Cousins is, at least not anytime soon, I think, is a trade demand. You know, DeMarcus, you know, from everything I'm hearing, is he wants to be in Sacramento. Now, maybe that's because, and it probably is because, he's powerful there. I mean, that's, he won the battle against George Karl, and I think despite the coaching change, he still wields a very big bat within that organization. Ownership still favors him in a lot of ways. So I think a deal could happen, but I don't think, Woj, that you're going to hear DeMarcus Cousins ask for it in April.
Right, and we'll see. Like, and then part of it is, how does the season start? How does this team do? Are they losing again? You know, if the team's not playing well and he's frustrated, and then the trade deadline's coming, and you go, like, you know, it's possible, but listen, they've got to start showing some progress there. They've got to start winning games. They've got to start showing that their trajectory is going up. Another flatline season or another season of dysfunction or frustration for him, then it's harder to know. But you're right. Right now, that's not a consideration. He's certainly not – he hasn't given the team that sense that he wants out. But I think – you know, they may have to look and see what could the market bear for them.
And they have to figure out what to do, if anything, with Rajon Rondo out there, who's going to be a free agent this summer, sign that short-term deal after the ugly stint in Dallas. I don't think they make him any kind of real offer in Sacramento. I think Rondo winds up hitting the free agent market again and struggles trying to find a team. I think the talent is undeniable. He was the assist leader this past year. He's still very much in the prime of his career, but I think his coachability is really hurting him right now. You know, maybe that changes with the right team and the right situation, but you know, I don't know that Rondo helped himself in getting a max deal, or not a max deal, even a long-term deal this summer.
I agree with you, Chris. I don't think it's, you know, from the Bill Kennedy episode that we reported out at the Vertical back, you know, early in the season. With the slur that he hurled at him in a preseason game. No one's ready to build their franchise around him. This is a point guard league now, and there was a time where people saw Rondo as a franchise point guard in the league. You know, I think he's looking at a one-year deal, maybe at okay money. But
and this is a really weak free agent point guard market, which is makes it even more amazing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a struggle for him, and I think his expectations are still pretty high financially. I think he still thinks that he should be seen as that. And I don't think it's out there for him. I mean, he'll have a job, but it's just not going to be. It'll just be very interesting to see what number does he come in at and what kind of a team, what kind of organization is willing to invest in him.
Does Minnesota feel any pressure to alleviate its point guard kind of logjam there? You know, they have Rubio entrenched as the starter, but Chris Dunn gets drafted fifth overall. And I don't know if, you know, Chris Dunn's ready to be handed the keys to running an NBA team, but if you draft him, if you keep him, presumably he is your point guard of the future. Do you see any urgency on the part of Tom Thibodeau to make a deal in the first couple of weeks of the summer?
I don't know that they've decided it. Now, they were shopping Rubio. We reported during our draft show, and I think just prior, you know, they put Rubio in offers last week. Now, that was before they knew they were going to get Chris Dunn. But they targeted Dunn all along. That's who they wanted. You know, they're as an organization, they're saying that they can play together. I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. I think you say that to try to protect Ricky's trade value if you're going to move him. You don't want to act like, you know, you're not going to come out and say they can't play together and hurt your leverage. You want people to believe, oh, no, we're happy going forward with them. It doesn't make any sense. And I think whether – now, he could start the season. I think Ricky could very well start the season there. You see how Dunn comes along, and then you're in a position where you're the Wolves of maybe doing a deal for Rubio at the trade deadline or even earlier, or maybe they do one this summer if the right deal. There's some teams out there who'd like a point guard, and you know, maybe some teams who strike out in free agency say, okay, we're going to let's see if we can put a package together to get Ricky. So I don't imagine a long-term partnership between those two. And, you know, it's too bad. Ricky loved playing there. He always felt very embraced by the fans. He was hurt. I had him on the podcast a couple months ago. We visited in Portland during the season. And, you know, he was hurt like that. You know, he knew that they had put him in trade talks before Tom Thibodeau took over. He wasn't the first one there. Milt Newton had. But hey, that's part of the league, and he gets that. But he's always wanted to play for that team. He loves those fans. He really saw, you know, he went through those difficult years with David Kahn and the dysfunction there, and saw this window, this avenue here with Karl-Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins, and saying, hey, this is what I've been waiting for here. I want to be the point guard here, but it looks like it's probably going to be somewhere else.
Too bad. Seems like he's a good fit in terms of a guy that doesn't need shots. You know, mm-hmm. who wants to pass the ball.
First-team all-league defender at his position.
Yeah, to be. Well, I'll finish with this. It's like when you watch the playoffs, you could almost see Bismack Biyombo get more money in real time. Like it was, hey, look at the game he had here, and that's another $5 million. And look at the game he had here, and that's another $2 or $3 million. I mean, he had, you know, maybe the most lucrative playoff run of any player in basketball. Is the market going to be there for him? You know, Toronto wants him back. He played a key role for them. It's a nice balance for whether it's Valanciunas or him at that five spot. But is the market going to be there for a guy that really, I mean, played well last year, but really burst onto the scene in the postseason?
It's going to be really interesting what the market is for Biyombo and how far people are going to go. I mean, for a player you can't run a play for.
Yeah.
I mean, he's now... You can argue with Tristan Thompson. Look at the impact he had on Cleveland. Nobody was complaining about his contract at the end of the year. Played very well for them. And if you have an owner who's willing to, you know, Thompson's different. He cost a lot of luxury tax, and they had to re-sign him. And he was their own player who they were giving a raise. That's easier to do than to bring in somebody from the outside. Biyombo is not Tristan Thompson. Thompson's a better player, more accomplished player. But he did have a good postseason. He had a couple of good games. But if you're Toronto, I really wonder how far Masai Ujiri is going to go to re-sign him. He's got Jonas is back, and they drafted Poeltl, and they have certainly some insurance up front. I don't know if you could have a salary structure where he's at $14, $15 million a year in Toronto. I think my sense is I don't want to throw a number out, but that 15, 14, 15, 16 range, I would be shocked if Toronto is willing to do that. I think Masai and Dwayne Casey would bet on their ability to go out there on the market and find somebody else who can play a comparable role, maybe not as good, but for a lot less. But it takes one team out there to do it. He's going to get paid, there's no question, but he will be a great litmus test to, is there really that much TV money out there? You know, so, but that's why this free agency is going to be fun. That's why we're going to do the show Thursday night. Leading into free agency, I think we'll have deals happening once we hit midnight. There'll be deals in the first extensions and signings there in that first hour in real time on our show. And this is going to be a fun one this summer.
I lied. One more for you. Cleveland and the Cavaliers' willingness to listen to offers or even shop Kevin Love this summer, do you think is what?
I think that David Griffin's come out since the end of the season and said they'd likely keep the group together. That doesn't mean an offer is going to blow you away that you wouldn't accept. But I do think this. I think it's more likely Love stays because teams that I've talked to who've had interest in Love in the past, who would still have interest in him, say to me, we wouldn't give as much as we would have 2 years ago. We wouldn't give up as much. And if that's the case, and Cleveland's not going to get an overwhelming offer to bowl them over, then they're even less likely to do it. Because they did, even though they still are struggling to figure out how he fits there, they won the championship. And the last memory people have is Kevin playing very well in Game 7, really impacting the final game of the finals. If they had lost that series, I think you'd make a good case he might be gone. But they won it. They had the parade. And if you're a GM, you're an organization, all you're going to do, it takes a lot of guts to undo that team, because then if you don't win, you're going to get blamed because that move changed it. Like, at least you have some, if you bring it back largely intact, You'd be like, hey, we brought a championship team back. It didn't win again. Like, you're opening yourself up for more criticism and management. And David Griffin, I'll say, Griff is a fearless guy in that way. He's not going to, he doesn't do his job scared. But there's also logic. Logically, you're probably better off just keeping it together.
Woj, appreciate it.
Chris,
thank you.
Got
a lot of work to do today. Free agent special, Thursday night. We're not quite sure what time we're going on the air just yet, but we'll be on the air at or around midnight, and it's going to be a great show. We'll be on for a while talking about all the latest deals that are coming up. So we'll look forward to that.
Chris, thanks for having me, man.
We'll talk to Frank Vogel, the Orlando Magic head coach, in just a minute, but I want to tell my listeners about MeUndies. You spend almost 24 hours a day in your underwear, but instead of making a statement like Superman's tights under his everyday clothes, your underwear is probably boring. MeUndies is here to change that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced Modal, a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. Nothing can describe the fit and feel of MeUndies, but once you try them on, you'll understand why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. If you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free. No questions asked. MeUndies has dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. Remember, Superman. Shipping is free in the US and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair. Get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/Mannix. That's MeUndies.com/Mannix for 20% off your order. MeUndies.com/Mannix. Well, welcome back. The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We're looking ahead towards free agency and the coaching changes that have happened over the last couple of months. And this next guy I want to talk to, you may have seen his resume briefly on Monster.com as he was looking for a job in between the like 2 days that he was between gigs. Frank Vogel, the new head coach of the Orlando Magic. What's up, Frank?
Chris Mannix, how you doing?
So what was it, like 48 hours of unemployment there? I mean, did you just have to like update your resume and stuff?
Yeah, there was no resume updating. It was a very quick turnaround, but it was definitely a chaotic time for sure. But one that, you know, hopefully landed me in a great situation down here in Orlando.
When was the last time you actually updated a resume?
Oh, that's a really good question. I might have been at the University of Kentucky. I'm not sure. You know, it's I haven't had a need for doing that throughout my career, thankfully.
So there's no, like, you know, send Alex Martins, you know, a updated bullet point, like 5 years, Indiana Pacers, all that?
Yeah, you know, like I said, I can't remember. You know what? When we got let go with the 76ers, you know, for 2 years, I was sending resumes out. And I had some stuff ready back then. That was the last time. But there was no resume involved in this exchange here and joining the Magic.
It must be an entirely different feeling for you. Because I remember during that time between the 76ers and when you jumped on OB staff in Indiana, you know, you were looking at a bunch of stuff. You're doing regional scouting. I remember you telling me potentially jumping back into the college ranks. I mean, how much different did it feel for you entering, you know, I hesitate to use the word unemployment. We kind of joke about that, but entering a time where you're without a job now versus being without a job 5-6 years ago.
Well, it was you know, a very different situation because of the demand and the interest that I received immediately, you know, upon being let go by the Pacers. You know, my agent called me. You know, he gave me a couple hours to digest what had just happened to be with my family and. He said, call me when you're ready to talk. And I called him a few hours later, and he said, I know you're upset, but you got a lot of interest right now. And basically said that every team that had an opening wanted to speak to me immediately. So, you know, that softened the blow for sure of what had just happened. And, you know, that was very different than, you know, obviously years ago when I was an assistant. You know, the competition for assistant coaching spots in this league is just incredible. And you know, when we were let go by Philadelphia, you know, there was a lot less certainty at that time.
That must have been, I mean, I can only imagine that would have been a really good feeling for you to go from, you know, obviously the disappointment of not being brought back in Indiana to the next day or hours after really having your agent say to you, like, man, there's so much out there. I mean, I would imagine there's still going to be sting, but I would imagine that would take a lot of it off, right?
It did, you know, and look, to be honest, you know, we were so happy in Indiana and, you know, so fond of that organization and that team and that community there. that it did take a little bit of the sting out of it. But, you know, I had said all along that I didn't want to coach anywhere else, that I wanted to be there and my family wanted to be there. So it didn't remove that, you know, the fact that we were going to have to relocate. And, you know, that's a difficult part of this business that I think the common fan doesn't appreciate, you know, how challenging that can be on the families. You know, but again, we feel like we found ourselves a great situation, a great new home down here in Orlando. The weather is great. We got a great organization. The team is up and coming, and the community is a good one to be a part of. So while there is a lot of discomfort with the uncertainty of relocating as a family, you know, things work out. And, you know, there's what they say, when one door closes, another one opens. And a lot of times the one that opens is better than one that closed. So we're hoping that's the case here.
You already got the coaching cliches down. I mean, Pat, one door closes. I like it.
I've been doing this for a while now.
You, you know, coaches are a different breed, Frank. You guys, I mean, you guys are workaholics. You're dedicated to working year in, year out. And sometimes if you look at your situation, some people might have said, well, maybe you'll just take a year off. You know, there'll be coaching vacancies the next year. How close were you to saying, I'm just going to take this year off and wait to see what happens next season?
You know, I was very close, to be honest. I think I was probably leaning towards that. Aside from the interest that that I received, I really felt like if it wasn't a great situation, that I wasn't going to, you know, just jump into something just to have a job or just to take advantage of an offer. I really wanted to find something that I felt fit my family and was a good next step in my coaching journey. And you know, there was a couple that were, you know, very interesting, very appealing, but you know, this one down here in Orlando, you know, was really something that I thought was a great situation, you know, with where this team is, the young roster, and how close they are to turning the corner, you know, in a great location, you know, a great city to live in with the weather and the state taxes. And, you know, if you're from the East Coast, you know, in New Jersey, or, you know, you're from Boston, you know, living in Florida, that's like West Coast people living in Hawaii, you know. that's something that, you know, everybody, you know, all of our parents, you know, when they retire, they move down to Florida. You know, it's just such a great place to live. So, you know, that combined with the first-class organization they have in place down here, and, you know, the up-and-coming roster that's, you know, in my mind, ready to really turn the corner and make a big splash over the next few years, was all very, very appealing.
Yeah, I want to get to what you have now in Orlando, but one of the great divides of opinion that was out there after your Indiana experience ended was the perception that it seemed like management out there had that team in some ways underachieved. I wrote, and many others, I feel like, echoed the sentiment that I thought you guys almost overachieved. I mean, you were one, you know, crappy Bismack Biyombo non-call from being in the second round of the playoffs with this team. When you look back at what that team achieved last year, do you feel like you got the most out of that group?
Yeah, I really do. I felt like it was a transition year. Paul George is coming off a broken leg, and you know, we really didn't know what to expect from his game. And he had some great moments, but some you know, he was up and down in terms of relearning his body throughout the course of the year. And you know, we're trying to play a different style of play. You know, our second best player was you know, a 19-year-old rookie that was finding his way. And you know, I felt like we did get the most out of that group, that we were playing our best basketball at the end of the season. And, you know, one of the reasons I was disappointed in, you know, being let go is I really felt like, you know, that I would be able to get 55, 60 wins out of that team the next year and be in a conversation for, you know, competing to be at the top of the East again, you know, the way we were prior to Paul George's injury. So, you know, it was a transition year. You know, we were happy with how it went. Obviously, we wanted to go further in the playoffs than we did. But that's the nature of this business, and, you know, you have to respect the decisions that are made and move on from it.
It's amazing the perception we have of situations based on one or two things. An example is the finals. You know, Draymond Green doesn't get suspended for Game 5. Maybe Golden State wins that game, and all of a sudden the Warriors are the two-time champs, ready to start a dynasty. Now you read all this stuff like, okay, they lost. What do they have to do to change to get better next season? Who could be gone next season? I mean, you're like, it just amazes me sometimes, because if you get that foul call, now that was a foul at the end of that game, Game 7 there on Biyombo.
Right.
You get that call, and are you a better coach public-wise? I mean, is that how it works?
Yeah, it does work that way. You know, fair or not, you know, that is how perception, you know, public, that's how the public perceives, you know, certain successes. And it is such a, you know, a fine line, you know, in terms of what can decide whether you advance in the playoffs and not advance in the playoffs. And, but look, it's a bottom line business. It's about wins and losses, and it's about advancing. And, you know, you can't look at all those little things, but, you know, there are, you know, a lot of instances where one play here, one play there, one call here, one call there, one basket going in and out, you know, can really change the fate of a lot of people and a lot of franchises.
How challenging was it, Frank, for you guys to score more? That came up in the postmortems of the Pacers, that they want to score more than they did this year. I mean, how was that a challenge for you finding different offensive options this year?
Well, of course, and you know, we did score more. That's what was, you know, the exciting thing for me. And again, we looked at it as a transition year where we did make a lot of growth. You know, in terms of, I think we were, you know, averaging 97 points, 8 points per game, and got up to 102, 103. You know, we improved in our fast break points per game. You know, I think we were moving in the right direction. But it's something that, look, when you're not winning, or even when you are winning, you always want to get better. And, you know, that was an area that, you know, we felt like we were dominant on the defensive end, but needed to improve on the offensive end. And, Larry and I were very aligned in how we were going to do that. We made some really positive progress in that regard last year. And, you know, a lot of those lessons that I learned in transitioning, you know, the style of play that we played, I intend to bring here to Orlando. So, you know, while we didn't get to sort of finish the job, you know, in Indiana, I feel like it was a great year for me personally, in terms of, you know, taking the magic into the new way that the NBA plays. Mm-hmm. You know, the game is different today, and I learned a lot of lessons last year.
You know, you'd said that you had hoped that things had worked out in Indiana. You wanted to be there even longer than you were. When did you have an inkling that it might not go that way? Was it before the end of the season, after the season?
You know, to be honest, I felt like there was a chance even prior to the season when, you know, we were looking for a contract extension and we weren't extended. You know, so anytime, you know, your front office allows you to go into a season in the last year of your deal, you know there's a chance that they could be thinking about a change. So, you know, I sort of coached the entire year with that mindset. And, you know, you just put it out of your head. You don't think about, you know, is there a chance, you know, I'm going to be let go. You don't think about that. You really just put every ounce of your effort and thought into winning as many games as you can and going as far into the playoffs as you can. And then you let the chips fall where they may. So, you know, that's when I kind of knew that there was a chance that could happen. I was hoping to prevent it, but I wasn't able to.
When you came in 5 years ago, you did a remarkable job in sort of transitioning that team from what they were into the team they ultimately became, which was a two-time conference finalist. I'm curious, do you feel like at the end of last season that your voice was resonating in the locker room, that you were getting through to the guys, a lot of the guys, which were, some of at least, were the same, in the same way you were earlier in your time there?
I do. And, you know, like I said, we played our best basketball of the season, you know, when it mattered most, you know, when we're going into the playoffs, the last few games, and then in the playoffs, giving a 56-win team a heck of a fight. It really, you know, a couple of different games, you know, decided on one or two possessions. You know, we could have advanced, but, you know, for a transition year, you know, I just felt like that was part of the process. I felt like the guys were really bought in. And, you know, but look, you know, there's a time in every organization for change. And, you know, I respect that. I believe that. And, you know, change could be, you know, work out for the better or could work out for the worse. But, you know, it's the front office is right, you know, to decide what direction they're going to take that franchise. So, you know, I have nothing but respect for the decision. You know, things happen for a reason. I'm in a great situation down here in Orlando. So not looking backwards, looking forward.
The last thing I'll ask you about Indiana was, you know, there was you know, when Larry Bird had the press conference, he suggested that, you know, you would try to convince him to not make this decision. That was immediately spun as like somehow you're groveling for your job or something like that. How did you, I mean, what was that last call with him like? I mean, how would you characterize it?
Well, it was, you know, I certainly didn't grovel or beg for my job. You know, I don't think Larry even said that. But a lot of
No, he didn't. He didn't. It was just going to spun that way.
But a lot of people came to me and didn't like that. that really didn't bother me, to be honest with you. Nothing, even the fact that it was done over the phone, it didn't really bother me. Larry does things his own way. If you know Larry, you appreciate him, you love him, and you know he does things a little bit differently. So none of that bothered me at all. You know, the conversation was just, I just talked to him a little bit like I just talked to you about what I thought about that team, about where I felt like I could take them, you know, to the top of the Eastern Conference again next year, you know, 55-60 win rate, you know, that I thought we were going to be able to accomplish. So I just, I told him I was, that I thought I could do that, you know, and asked him to reconsider, you know, with a smile on my face, and we laughed about it. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't anything, you know, more than that, and you know, too much has been made about it, to be honest.
All right, so you pick Orlando, and you pick them, and I use that word because, you know, you had some options out there, but I don't know if you had other concrete offers per se, but, you know, you talked to Memphis, you talked to the New York Knicks, you know, there were teams out there that were very interested in hiring you. What was it about Orlando that maybe separated that job from others?
You know, I think the future. You know, first and foremost, the roster that Rob Hennigan has put together here, the young core is very, very talented and has tremendous upside. So on a personal level, it reminded me of the team I took over in Indiana, you know, with a young Paul George and a young Lance Stevenson and a young Roy Hibbert, and, you know, a chance to kind of mold these guys, you know, the way that I would like to see them play. And you know, that similarity, I had a media connection with Rob Hennigan when we interviewed. And, you know, as you start looking at the situation even deeper, the ownership is great. The new facility here is one that is attractive for free agents to come in and want to be a part of. The state of Florida is an attractive place to live. You know, many, many pro athletes that play in the city or don't play in the city have homes here. You know, it's just an attractive place to be. I feel like with the young core that we have in place here, you know, I feel like we can make some noise, but, you know, it's definitely a free agent destination. You know, a place where I feel like guys are going to want to come and play for the Orlando Magic, you know, especially because of what we're building here. They want to play for a winner. They want to play in a great city. And, you know, all those things fit with this situation. So it just made it a very, very attractive situation for me.
That the job, Frank, was open in the first place was surprising. The Scott Skiles resignation kind of came out of nowhere for a lot of people. Did you ask about kind of what happened there, or did you just – you know, look at it as that's a totally different situation than mine. I'm not all that interested.
I did a little bit of, background research, just talking to some people. I didn't really talk to Rob about it. I didn't really talk to Chris Giles about it. I've always been of the mindset that, you know, relationships can be different and relationships can go bad with different people. That doesn't mean that, you know, they're going to be a bad relationship with me. I've always had the ability to sort of get along with others and work well with others. So I didn't feel like there was going to be any kind of issues in regard to, you know, what happened with whatever happened with Coach Giles and his decision. You just leave that go and respect that and feel like things are going to be different with me.
You're a different place coaching-wise than you were when you took over in Indiana. You've had tremendous success. You're one of the best young coaches out there. Anyone will say that. Does that change your desire to have maybe more input when it comes to personnel moves, or how do you view the coach general manager relationship, what it should be?
Well, it really doesn't change that at all for, you know, in terms of what point in my career I'm at. You know, just because I've coached for 5.5 years as opposed to being a rookie or first year coach, you know, it doesn't change things at all. In fact, I really like the separation of you know, the front office and head coach. I believe in, you know, letting them do their job and putting together a team. I believe in working together with them to create that vision of how are we going to, you know, build this and what style of play and what personnel we want to target. But I believe in ultimately, you know, say have a whole division of our organization to study personnel and to do all the background research and to, you know, study the draft and, you know, bring the types of players that they know that I like, and then I go out and create the vision on the court. You know, I think that's a healthy separation, one I've always been really comfortable with in working with the Pacers and Larry Bird and Kevin Pritchard, and, you know, one that is off to a very strong start here in Orlando with Rob Hennigan.
Well, I want to ask you about that style because, you know, for, what, 4.5, 5 years maybe,
you played a Powerball style. You had the personnel for it. You had Roy Hibbert. You had David West. You had the guys that were built to play a physical half-court brand. You transitioned, albeit briefly, kind of into a smaller style. You talked about how the NBA is changing. When you look at the personnel, and you've had a little bit of time to kind of sink your teeth into it, have you been able to kind of figure out what kind of style you'd like to play with this team next year?
I have, and you know, we're definitely going to still commit to the defensive end. You know, I feel like winning starts with defense and rebounding. We will commit to that end, and we will be great on that end of the floor. And what I like about this team is I love the ability, the athleticism that we have. When you look at guys like Victor Oladipo and Aaron Gordon and Elfrid Payton, Mario Hezonja, I mean, these guys can get out and fly and attack the rim. And, you know, you have a skilled big man in Nick Vucevic, a few other guys even at the big positions that can really space the floor, you know. And I think we're going to be a different offensive team than what we've seen in Indiana in terms of our ability to run the floor, to space with our bigs, you know, to play a really dramatically different style of play offensively while maintaining what we've known, come to know and trust on the defensive end. You know, I feel like we're going to be able to get both things done and win at a high level. So I'm really excited about, you know, what free agency is going to look like, what additions we have, and then digging my hands in and getting with this young core that we have in place here.
I'm sure you're excited on various levels about a lot of guys that you're going to be, you know, inheriting and coaching up next year. But is there one guy on the roster that when you took this job, you were like, I really want to see what I can do with him, or I'm really excited about the future of this particular guy?
There's really not one. And that's what's so appealing about this job is, you know, it's not like, hey, you know what, we're going to New Orleans and it's, you know, it's Anthony Davis. It's all about one guy and Anthony Davis. I mean, there are several young guys on this roster that I feel have a great chance to really explode over the next 2, 3, 4 years, you know, during my tenure here. And I'm excited to get to work with all these guys.
I feel like, Frank, that in some situations, losing kind of begets losing. And what I mean by that is when you're kind of accustomed to failure, when you're young guys, it can kind of steamroll when things go bad last season. And from my perspective, that's kind of what happened last year with this team. When things got tough, they just hadn't, the younger guys haven't had the success to kind of dig their way out of it. How much does this team need to, you know, kind of become more disciplined or you know, and change sort of the culture a little bit of what they have been in years past?
Well, I thought they played a pretty disciplined brand of basketball last year with Coach Giles. You know, I thought he did a really good job with these guys. A lot of times it's just about youth makes mistakes, you know, and as guys get a little bit older and they get a little more experience and, you know, hopefully they get, you know, what I hope to bring here, some stability in the system and style of play that we're going to implement. You know, those things go away, the mistakes and the breakdowns, and they become minimized. And these guys gain confidence and grow in the belief that they, what they can accomplish. And, you know, it's my job to make sure that everybody's feeling good about their role and feeling good about their individual growth and how it's going to contribute to the team growth. And I feel like all those things are going to happen this year.
Is that what you, when you've been, you know, digging into this team a little bit and looking at what they did last year, is that what you saw kind of from them at the end of last season? Because the first couple of months, Orlando looked like a playoff team. I mean, they look great. All the young guys that you're talking about, they were playing at, you know, almost above their heads to some degree. And then things kind of derailed in the second half of the season. From what you've studied about them, where did you see them kind of go south, and what can you do to correct that?
Well, again, you know, I think they just hit a rut. You know, like all young teams, you know, are vulnerable to do. And, you know, the Eastern Conference last year was very, very strong and very, very deep. So, you know, as you're trying to break through, there's a lot of teams, you know, this version of the Orlando Magic from this past season played in the Eastern Conference 3 years ago, they would have been, you know, probably in position to be a 6 or 7 seed, and not at 35 wins, but, you know, with weaker competition, you know. And I just think they faced a different Eastern Conference, you know, at a time where they're trying to get over the hump, and it was just too much for them. But, you know, I feel like this year is going to be another step for them.
The Eastern Conference is getting better, especially at the back half of it. I mean, Detroit, they're a rising team, and they were the 8 seed last year. When you look at what this team could accomplish next year, do you set team goals for this group? Do you want to get to X wins? Do you want to get to X playoff spot? How do you look at next season in particular?
Yeah, we'll look at all that stuff. You know, it's I don't really believe in putting, you know, X amount of wins or things like that. You know, to me, it's about the process, you know, and it's about building a winner on the court and a culture and how you do things and, you know, doing the little things, you know, every day, building the habits that you know are going to lead to winning basketball and not getting caught up on a given day with the result. You know, if you do things the right way and you lose, you don't change. You keep doing them the right way. And, you know, that's what this process is going to be about for us.
And I'm guessing you have to finish with a better record than Indiana.
Of course. Look, that's going to be tough. That's going to be really good. You know, I really believe in what they've built there. Larry's done a great job. Coach Nate is, you know, one of my best friends and one of the best coaches I've ever worked with. So their future is very bright as well.
Were you good with your assistant being elevated? I don't know if that's tough or not. I mean, how'd you view Nate getting that job?
The only thing I didn't like about it is it left me without a coaching staff. All those guys got to stay in Indiana. I would have definitely brought all those guys here. And I was absolutely good with, you know, Coach Nate taking that job. He's one of the best in the business, one of the classiest men I've ever worked with. And if I'm not going to be there, then, you know, I certainly would want that organization in the hands of somebody like Coach Nate and Dan Burke and Popeye. All those guys are very, very close friends and, you know, I consider them really family members to me. So I was happy for all of them.
But before I let you go, Frank, one of the more intriguing conversations, at least from the outside, that I thought you had this offseason was with Phil Jackson and the Knicks. And I know you're a New Jersey guy. And, you know, how had you interacted with Phil before? I mean, what was that discussion in a general sense like?
You know, it was terrific, really, to have a chance to spend a couple days interviewing with him. I've always been fascinated with his approach. I always have been. You know, it's a big reason why I hired Brian Shaw a couple of years ago. And while I was a regional scout for them back in, I think, 05, 06, I didn't really interact with Phil very much. I dealt mostly with the assistants. So, you know, to have a chance to have dinner with him and, you know, to spend a half a day just on a whiteboard, you know, comparing notes and talking about philosophies was really a great moment for me, you know, in terms of being able to spend some time that I really, really admire and look up to.
Did you share, you know, common philosophical themes? You come from different sort of perspectives, viewpoints, I guess, when how you came up the ranks. I mean, Phil is Phil, and you came up, obviously, the longer way going through Rick Pitino, Boston, Philadelphia. I mean, how did your philosophies match up?
I thought there was a lot of similarities, to be honest. No, a lot of similarities. You know, I'm not going to get into all the details, but there's a lot of ways to skin this cat, you know, in this business in terms of coaching and what your style of coaching is going to be like. And, you know, how rigid are you going to be on certain things and how flexible are you going to be on certain things. And I like the way he loosens the reins a little bit and, you know, just trusts in guys to get the job done, you know, works with them to create the disciplines on the court and with their approach, you know, to build a winner. So I feel like that there was a lot of similarities. And like I said, it was just a great experience for me to spend some time with him.
Are you going to become like a Disney World guy now?
I've already been there.
Of course you have. Week. Of course you have.
You know, I anticipate a lot of friends visiting and, you know, letting them go to the park and tell them to call me when they're done.
Is there like a magic coach's pass for that? Like, do you have special access to Disney World?
I haven't explored that yet. I just decided to do it on my own when I did it this past week. But, you know, I'm sure there's some kind of connection with them, yes.
I have the worst Disney World experience. You remember, I remember back in the day, I wore glasses early on in my life. And my last time at Disney World, I rode Space Mountain and my glasses fell off. And that was the last time I went to Disney World.
That's incredible.
It's like a sad kid story.
my Father's Day gift is my youngest daughter said that for the first time in her life, she's going to go on Space Mountain with me. So that was a big moment in my recent past, and we had a blast with it.
Well, Frank, congratulations on the new job. I'm sure you're going to do a great job there. Did a fantastic job in Indiana as well. Looking forward to seeing what you guys do this offseason, and thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Of course, Chris. Take care.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to all our sponsors and to Adrian Wojnarowski, the editor of The Vertical, and to Frank Vogel, the head coach of the Orlando Magic. Remember, you can get this podcast, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, anywhere you can find podcasts. And also, subscribe to Adrian's podcast and to the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick. We'll see you next week.